Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dave Gardner. He hosts two fascinating podcasts about sustainability, the Overpopulation podcast about solving world overpopulation, and the Growth Busters podcast about sustainable living and finding a cure for growth addiction. World Population Balance, the nonprofit Dave heads, is launching the One Planet, One Child billboard campaign to demonstrate how we can solve the human overpopulation emergency humanely, voluntarily, and beautifully. So first off, thank you for your work on the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and I've been following your work for a long time, so thank you so much for what you do.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. So the first question is, what is Overshoot?
Well, that's a great question, because that's really on my mind. That is probably one of the most important things for people around the world to understand. And I think so many people don't even realize we're in Overshoot. So what is it? Well, my definition would be that the scale of human activity on the planet is demanding more from the Earth than she can sustainably provide year after year. And I base, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm a communicator. I kind of joke sometimes that I try to run the ad agency for planet Earth. I'm really trying to look out for it. But I turn to the scientists, and I think the best scientific inquiry into the carrying capacity these days is done by the Global Footprint Network, and they estimate that we are close to demanding twice the renewable resources each year that the planet can actually renew in a year. So that is Overshoot, and of course there's a lot of empirical evidence before our eyes and scientific report after scientific report giving us lots of big clues, things like desertification, deforestation, climate disruption, species extinction. Those are just a few off the top of my head.
And so Overshoot is not something that is, it's a larger category, not just applicable to humans. I mean, if you had a bunch of deer on an island, the island could support a certain number, and they could overshoot, and then it would harm the island. Is that how overshoot generally works?
Yeah, exactly. And not only harm the island, but actually harm the deer population as well, because eventually the deer population would, some of them would start to starve if they outgrew their island, and so there would be some dire consequences. Nature has a way of kind of correcting course. And I guess all species do that. And I think most of them, as I understand it, kind of, ebb and flow in cycles. They do tend to get a little carried away if allowed to. And then Mother Nature steps in and predators or disease or famine, or hunger will correct the population. I think it's more complicated for the human race because we're darn, and in some ways it's great that we're so smart, and in some ways maybe unfortunate that we're so smart that we figure out ways to kind of artificially push the boundaries for a time. And so that makes it really, Derek, impossible for us to come up with one right answer. If somebody says, well, okay, what is the carrying capacity of planet Earth? How many people can it support? Because it really depends on how we're behaving. If we're, driving Hummers and flying private jets and have McMansions in four different cities and have a private yachts, then the carrying capacity of the planet, might just be, maybe 50 million or 100 million people. But if we were all to say we'll live extraordinarily simple lives, the life of a monk or something like that, then it could be that the carrying capacity of the planet might be, I don't know, might be 12 billion human beings. But the scientists that I respect that I think have done the most serious inquiry into that, how many human beings can the planet support, have estimated that if we were all content to live, they say a modest European lifestyle, which doesn't sound too bad. Sounds fun. That probably means a glass of wine every now and then. The planet can probably sustainably support somewhere around 2 billion people. And I don't worry too much about how precise we are at that. I just know you know, whether it's 1 billion or 2 billion or 3 billion, it's a lot less than today's nearly 7.8 billion. So I know which direction we need to head if we want to work on the population part of that equation. Of course, there's really two parts of the equation that determine our impact on the planet. One is how many of us there are, and then the other is how we're behaving, whether we're all eating beef, whether we're all driving and flying, you know, whether we're living in big houses or small houses and air conditioning them or not, things like that.
So I'm going to go a slightly different direction for a second. And I'm going to ask your personal story on this, because I decided I didn't want children probably when I was about 7 or 8, in great measure because I thought there were already too many humans on the planet.
My gosh, that was very early in life.
Well, I didn't actually get a vasectomy until I was maybe 42 or 43. So I made the decision, but it was like, you know, I didn't absolutely commit. You know, it could have possibly gone another direction. It wasn't like at 7 years old, I decided my fate forever.
Yeah, it was probably good that you kept your options open for a little while beyond 7.
Exactly. I'm a Sagittarius, so I have to keep my options open. I'm wondering my point is that this issue was important to me from 7. Whether I chose not to have children or not is not the point so much as at 7 and 8, I was aware. Well, I'm going to go ahead and tell a story real quick. Sorry to take up in your interview. That when I was about 7, in second grade, a subdivision went in right next door to where I lived, and all the grasshoppers disappeared, all the meadow disappeared, the cottonwood trees, the meadowlarks, and they all got replaced by houses. And I remember thinking when I was 7 years old, this can't go on forever. If they keep doing this, if they keep taking the homes away from the meadowlarks won't have any place to live. And so basically, when I was 7, I didn't have the language, but I understood that you can't have infinite growth on the planet.
Wow. You were ahead. You, at that point, let me interrupt. Sorry. You were ahead of, you know, nearly every member of Congress today in your understanding of physics at age 7. I'm impressed.
So thank you for saying that. I'm wondering about your story on coming to understand, because it seems so obvious that there are, you know, and you just chat with people and everybody has stories of, oh man, I can't go back to where I grew up because where I grew up, there was this oak tree behind and now it's been cut down and there was this beautiful pond and now that's all been taken over. Everybody has stories like that. So I'm wondering, how did you come to care about population and growth, both, because those are obviously intertwined.
I'll try not to make it too long a story, and it's kind of a two-part story. Because one is an impression was made on me when I was, a teenager. I developed a good, strong conservation ethic from. I was lucky enough to attend some really neat camps that were a part of the public school curriculum at the time, and so got some good doses of conservation ethic there, and. I don't remember who, but somebody handed me Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey. So I read that when I was in high school, and that is a great book. And that had a real foundational impact on my way of thinking. And I know that I was aware of The Population Bomb by Paul and Ann Ehrlich when that was published in 1968, and the first Earth Day 50 years ago in 1970. A lot of that had an impact on me, but you know, I wasn't quite in high school in 1970, in the first Earth Day, so I wasn't paying that much attention. And in fact, I went on to graduate from high school, go to college, ended up becoming a filmmaker. And although I worked on a PBS series for a few years, I decided I wanted a little bit more sleep and a little bit more money. And went to the dark side and ended up working for Fortune 500 companies, producing propaganda films for them for over 20 years and trying to be a good provider. I got married. I had 2 kids, stopped after 2, got a vasectomy immediately because the population bomb had made an impression on me. So I felt like I was doing my part when I stopped at 2. And that decision would have been about 1990. But I wasn't activated around climate change. I wasn't doing anything to help protect and preserve this planet that I really truly loved. I'd really developed this great love for nature. I loved camping and hiking and all that. But I think I did what almost every Earth Day demonstrator did, got caught up and got onto the treadmill of, getting married and trying to be a good provider and trying to survive. And it's easy to run out, not have time to do all the right things. So it wasn't until, 1993 that I started getting my path realigned. I made a move back to my hometown from a huge city. I'd been in Dallas, Texas for 20 years, and there's no nature. All there is in Dallas is money. Money and cars, as far as the eye can see. But that kept me there for a long time because there were all these big corporate headquarters that helped me pay the bills. Those were my clients. But I finally just got sick of it and had enough and moved back to Colorado Springs in 93. And it was a lifestyle move. I wanted to raise my children in a quieter, safer community. I wanted to I didn't want it to take me an hour to get from one side of town to the other, things like that. But I watched during the 90s, I watched that quality of life go downhill as the city of Colorado Springs was hell-bent for leather to grow. That was their metric for success. How fast is our population growing? And that just sickened me. It was kind of like if you bought a, and I hate to use these materialistic metaphors, but I think most people will get it. Let's say you bought a Corvette, and but every day when you walked out into the garage to get in your Corvette, it was a little bit more like a Ford F-150 pickup. And after 10 or 15 years, it was a pickup truck instead of a Corvette. And I saw that happening, and I hated it, and I figured there wasn't anything we could do about it until around 2000, 2001. The American West really entered a big period of drought. Drought was really making headlines. And I thought to myself, you know what? Water, that's something we can't really change. That might be the thing. Of course, little did I know we would try. We could build dams and pipelines like crazy. But I figured maybe a limited water supply might actually cause rational thought in the American West and in my hometown of Colorado Springs. So I then started kind of actively trying to get involved in local politics and point out some of the ways that the city was subsidizing growth because the city fathers all thought that was, the source of all prosperity, and tried to get, other citizens excited about this so that we could have a louder voice. And I really wasn't making very much progress, but ultimately, following 9/11, when my all the work I was doing for the dark side, all my corporate clients, they stopped spending money after 9/11. There was a period of about a year where they just were afraid to spend money, and so suddenly I was having to pick up the phone and dial for dollars and look for work. And I decided, heck, if I'm going to have to look for work, I want the work to be something that I want to do, a story that I want to tell. And that was when I decided I'm going to produce a documentary about population growth and our society's celebration of it instead of our society trying to get unhooked from it. During that journey, it took me several years because I was raising money while I was researching and producing the film. It took me a little while to discover that that our problem wasn't just population growth, but it was worship of economic growth. That I came to that reckoning a little later on. So by the time I finished that documentary, Growth Busters Hooked on Growth, it really was a film that I think was about 50% about our irrational behavior around population growth and 50% around our suicide mission of pursuit of economic growth.
And so can you talk for a moment about exponential growth, just sort of give a quick primer for those who may not know what it is.
Okay. And, you know, I just want to note, I suppose your regular listeners know this, that you're, you know, being an excellent host and asking questions, you know, asking good questions so that I can share what I know. But of course, you know all the answers to these questions. But that's what a good interviewer does. They're not worried about whether their audience thinks they know the answers or not. So exponential growth is really it's the reason why when you look at the global human population and the history of it, the graph is like a hockey stick laying down on the long side. It's fairly flat for millions and millions and millions of years. And then only, you know, a couple hundred years ago did it start to turn up and did human population really start to grow. But when it started to really grow, it just kicked into high gear, and that was enabled by agriculture, and then fossil fuels, and the industrial age, and medical advances. All these things kind of came to be the perfect storm that made it so that we could just, you know, it was like an infestation of human beings, like a plague of locusts. Only it was a plague of human beings, and so we went from fewer than a billion people on the planet in 1900 to less than 200 years later, we're already up getting close to 8 billion people. So that is exponential growth, and it happens because the number in the population really does depend on the generation before. You know, the size of each generation is going to have an impact on the size of the successive generation, because you got, you know, your mom and dad get married, they have four kids. You know, I'm talking about in ancient history, because hopefully we're not doing that anymore. But let's say back in 1960, they would have four kids. If each of those four kids got married and had four kids, you know, look at the number of grandchildren there are. And then if each of those grandchildren got married and had four kids, you know, the family tree just blossoms. That is exponential growth. That's the kind of thing that happens with a virus too. So it's multiplication. It's really leveraged. And one example that I think most people don't think about, because very few people question this. They kind of understand this with population, but they question any criticism of our pursuit of robust economic growth. But the economy is the same way. It's just like your savings account that's earning interest, not very much interest these days, but the interest depends on the principal amount in your savings account. And a year after you open that account, you start getting interest on the principal plus the interest that you earned. So it builds on itself in an exponential fashion. And a lot of people, when they're explaining exponential growth, they like to use doubling time to explain how long it takes for something to double. Because if it's growing at a steady rate, if it's a population of bacteria or human beings or deer, or it's money in your savings account, if it's growing, say, 3% per year, then to compute the doubling time, you would divide 72 by 3, and you get, what, about 20, 24, something like that. So it's about, the doubling time is about 24 years. So you start with an economy of, let's say that's just represented by 1. 24 years later, the economy is 2 times that size. 24 years after that, it's not 3 times that size. No, it's 4 times that size, because it's doubled again. And then just 24 years later, it's doubled again. So it's 8 times that size. And none of us are going to be alive for 720 years, but at just 3% annual growth rate for our economy, which is what everybody, you know, it's hard to find very many people around the world, and especially policymakers, who wouldn't cheer for 3% or better annual economic growth. But in 720 years, we would have an economy 1 billion times the size of today's economy. And I don't think anybody would, if they stopped and thought about it, would say, would believe that that's possible. Because the economy is, you know, that's the all of these, you know, it's money changing hands, but money changes hands when something is pulled out of the ground, when it's mined and converted into a product and sold, or when energy is burned, you know, taking a flight or performing a service, running computer servers, you know, their economic activity has a price that it extracts from the planet. And we've been working, you know, some of us have been working hard to try to make it more efficient so that it's not as hard on our life supporting ecosystems as it used to be. But there's a limit to how efficient we can be with that. You know, we've kind of reached that limit. So now if we decide that we're going to continue this pursuit of robust economic growth, we're basically, that's the suicide mission. We're going to kill the planet.
But when you were talking a little bit earlier about, you mentioned suicide mission earlier, and you also said that our discourse around population is, I believe the phrase you used was not rational, but it was something like that.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, can you show that? It seems pretty obvious to me, but can you show that to audience members that it's not? I mean, honestly, the fact that you and I are even having to discuss this seems crazy to me.
Yeah.
It's obvious that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And can you talk about your understanding of the perhaps reasons for the non-rationality of the discussion it clearly is a suicide mission. I'm sorry, I'm going to go on again. I just got interviewed a couple days ago by a couple people who were talking about how we can change society going into the future. And I was talking about exactly what you're saying, that this culture is killing the planet. So our stolen scientists are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish by 2050. And they were saying, but Derek, people don't want to give up their television or whatever it is. And I was like, so the argument for killing the planet is I want my MTV? And I kept saying, look, don't get mad at me. I'm simply saying what is and isn't possible. And they're saying, but we want this. And I'm like, but it doesn't matter what you want. I'm telling you what's possible. And I'm just rambling. So please take this any direction is smarter than my question.
Oh, that's a great question, a great launching pad. And, part of the answer is something that I think maybe you have some theories about it, but I keep looking for someone out there who has the silver bullet, who comes to us and says, I can tell you exactly why the human race is in such utter denial of limits and won't do anything to rein ourselves in, because I don't have a really good answer to that. But I have a kind of an interesting process that I went through to lead me to be outspoken about the population side of the issue. And that's a little bit harder to be outspoken about these days, because it's a subject that's been brushed under the rug for decades. It's kind of poisonous. People have such a misunderstanding. There have been a few bad actors and a few bad attempts to do something about overpopulation that have made it easy for people to leap to all kinds of conclusions about everything that's wrong with doing anything about overpopulation. But let me take you through the.
Why do you hate babies?
Why do you hate humans? And the answer to that is, you know, I love babies. That's why I'm doing this. I'm trying to make sure that there's a shot at a decent life for all the children of the world, because we're busy just completely burning down the house to keep warm, and we're leaving them, a shitstorm. So we know all the scientific reports tell us that we're in overshoot. We are actually in the process of slowly crippling Earth's life-supporting ecosystems. And with each passing year, they're less capable of meeting our needs than they were the year before. And so that's not a good position to be in. We know that there's two big multipliers that have influenced that. One is our behavior, you know, whether we're eating a plant-based diet or meat, whether we're burning fossil fuels or not, whether we're living in McMansions or living more modest lives, all those kind of things, whether we're using plastic straws or not, even, you know, filters into that to some small degree, and even recycling, although recycling makes so little difference relative to what we really need to be doing. So there's our behavior. That's one part of the equation. And then there's how many of us doing the misbehaving. So our population numbers. We've got those two things. And if we, let's say our goal is to leave a decent planet for the children of the world. We want them to have a habitable climate. We want them to have roofs over their heads. We want them to have jobs, food on the table, you know, and maybe even access to some of the beautiful nature that we were lucky enough to enjoy. So how do we get back into balance? Well, we're going to have to deal with one or both of those two multipliers. So Global Footprint Network tells us that we're pretty close to two planet living right now, and we need to get back to one planet living. So we really need to cut that impact in half, just roughly. So let's say we're uncomfortable talking about overpopulation because, you know, there's any number of reasons that people are afraid to talk about it. They think it's racist because some people, when they've talked about it or tried to address it, were focusing on reducing the births in, you know, people with black skin or brown skin or people in some other country or people of some other religious persuasion, not them. You know, there's some people who have felt that way and acted that way. That doesn't mean everybody is, but that's one of the things that poisoned the overpopulation subject. Another is that there's this fairly universal feeling that we have procreative freedom, that nobody can dictate what we do in the bedroom and how many children we choose to conceive. And I'm not even going to argue that point. I have no interest today in dictating anybody's family size decision. I just want to make sure everyone is fully informed and makes an informed and considered decision about family size. I think if they understand the implications of their family size decision on the quality of life for any children that they might bring into the world, that they would make the most loving decision that they could, which would be to, these days, knowing what we know, the most loving thing you can do is to either not bring a child into the world, or if you simply must, to limit yourself to just bringing one child into the world. But let's say, yeah, that's just too uncomfortable. We're not going to deal with that. Let's just solve the problem over on the economic side, how our overconsumption. Let's deal with that. Well, if we do the math, and this is all just kind of back of the cocktail napkin math, just kind of get us into the ballpark. You know, if you take our close to $90 trillion economy and you divide that in half, and then you divide that by about 7.8 billion people on the planet so that you figure out what's a fair share for everyone walking the Earth today, you end up with, I think you end up with about maybe $6,000 US per person of economic activity that would be sustainable. That would be one planet living. And so this is just kind of a rough proxy, but it'll get you in the ballpark. So it would be kind of like you've got to take a pay cut. You've got to be willing to live on a $6,000 a year salary if you want to ignore population and cut your consumption so that you're living sustainably for today, at today's level of population. Now, of course, if the population keeps on growing, then you're going to have to live on an even smaller salary next year and the year after that and the year after that. And I'm thinking, you know what? That's going to be a tough case to make. In fact, I'm not even willing to live that simply. I wish I was, but I'm not. So that tells me, you know what, we really need to work on both sides of the equation. We need to be dealing with the population numbers and with our level of consumption so that it's not such a, you know, such a dramatic and unpleasant adjustment to try to get into sustainable balance. So that's kind of the math that I did. And that tells me we've got to get over our fears about talking about overpopulation. And we've got to, so my mission in doing the overpopulation podcast, which I produce and host for World Population Balance, which is a great nonprofit whose mission is just to alert and educate people to improve overpopulation literacy. So that's one of my main missions, because there are too few organizations and too few people out there championing that information, just because it has been so poisonous. There are a lot more nonprofits and environmental organizations and environmentalists who are working on the overconsumption side of the equation. But of course, the truth is that few of them are really being honest with you about, or with themselves, about the level of degrowth that would be necessary in order to get into true sustainable balance, if they're going to ignore our numbers, especially. So I might be shortchanging things here a little bit. So that's kind of a big part of the work I'm doing, is I'm saying we need, you know, I'm never going to suggest that we should only work on our numbers and ignore our profligate overconsumption. We definitely need to be working on that. You know, we need to be giving up fossil fuels, and we need to get over our love affair with American automobile. And gosh, there's just so many things that, you know, don't really add to our happiness in life, but really are killing the planet. But we, at the same time, we will never get where we need to go if we're not willing to make sure that everybody understands that the number of us on the planet makes a huge difference. And the days of, you know, having 3 or 4 or 8 kids are behind us. It's really not in the best interest of the next generation to do that. And the good news is, we've really been working on solving that problem just voluntarily. Over the past 50 years, we've cut the, you know, the average number of kids around the planet in half without having to commit murder, without having to make it illegal to have a second or third kid, without taxing people to extremes for their third or fourth kid. People just naturally have been choosing to have smaller families. So meanwhile, what have they been doing on the overconsumption side? Well, pretty much it'd be a very tiny percentage of the population that's doing anything to skinny up their lives, unfortunately. So that tells me that the low-hanging fruit, the easier solution to get into play, is to really just increase our progress on moving to a small family norm. Average fertility rate average for the globe is about 2.45 today, and we need to get that down below 2. We need to get it down close to 1. We need to make one child families the norm. So even in a place like the United States, where we're at about 1.75, I think, today, and a lot of people think that's mission accomplished, that's below replacement rate, it's not good enough in a country full of, you know, profligate over consumers. So we need to make faster progress and continue the progress if we want to have a planet that's left. So I am advocating really strongly for making sure everybody just understands that they know we're in overshoot, that they know overpopulation has to be part of the solution. It's not the only part, but if you want to leave that out, you will not succeed.
So I remember reading that about half of the children who are born on the planet right now were not actively planned.
Yeah.
This suggests one fairly easy step we can take. And can you also talk about on your website, you have some solutions to humanely solving overpopulation, that what are some means that have been, what have studies shown that have lowered birth rates?
Okay. Well, you're right that that it is close to half of the births are unplanned. That doesn't mean that they wouldn't happen in a planned way, you know, later on. But that does represent a huge opportunity for us if we just the way to solve that part of the problem is to improve access to family planning, to contraception, make it easy, convenient, accessible, maybe even free. It would be worth it to make it free. But also, that doesn't completely solve that problem, because there are still some societies that have a lot of just some cultural baggage where they're, you know, where for the men, it's a sign of their manhood. It's kind of like in the U.S., how big is your pickup truck? Well, in some parts of the world, it's how many children have you sired? And so that, you know, we've got to get over that. So just making contraception available isn't going to solve that. But there are efforts to kind of get those cultures moving in the right direction. And let's see. The other thing is, we do know, of course, that when women are educated and they have opportunities to have meaningful lives beyond motherhood, that they tend to choose to have smaller families. So educating women and gender equity around the world, those are things that those are some of the easy ways, and they're, you know, they're really valuable and noble causes in and of themselves. I mean, you know, women should have opportunity. Women should be educated. They should have an equal say in every family decision, whether you're trying to solve world overpopulation or not. It just so happens that that also helps to bring down the typical family size. Some people, because they are afraid to talk about overpopulation, they like to just leave that brushed under the rug. They think that they can, they sort of tell us, you know, don't worry about it. Don't talk about it, because we know what the solution is. We can tap dance around it. We can pretend that we're not doing anything about overpopulation. We can just pretend like we're just trying to educate and empower women. I just don't happen to think that's going to get us there, because I know plenty of educated, empowered women who have 8 kids. You know, how many kids did Queen Victoria had? What, 11 kids or something like that? You know, we owe it to the women of the world to not hide the full information about the implications of their family size choices. So I choose to just boldly talk about this poison subject. And the more we talk about it, the less of a third rail it will be, because I think everybody needs to understand what's at play when they're making their family size decision. What part of your question did I not answer?
No, that's good. The part of the difficulty, I mean, so basically, I mean, yes, of course, educating women and teaching little girls to read, all that is incredibly important. And one of the things it does is it points out the insanity of our predicament, because really all we have to overcome in order to get to where both you and I want to go is to overtake a couple thousand years of Abrahamic patriarchal religions, capitalist growth imperative that's been tossed on top of it.
Yeah.
So that's I'm not meaning to be cynical at all. Yes, educating women is so important, and educating people is so important. And we still, we're faced with this Abrahamic, with this control, this male control of women's lives.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, I want to, having sort of dropped that bomb, I want to go a slightly different direction for a second. You mentioned soap operas on the worldpopulationbalance.org website. And can you talk about the the importance of soap operas in fighting the problems that we face.
Well, I think that's one of the better efforts underway to influence that culture, you know, the cultural inertia that's keeping some societies really stuck in high fertility rates. It's just, you know, the norm has been almost refusing to budge. And, you know, I know better than to think that I can, you know, I'm a filmmaker and a podcaster now. Do I think I can record a series of podcasts or make a film to show in Niger, which is the country in sub-Saharan Africa that has the highest fertility rate these days, which I think is around 6 or almost 6. Do I think that I can, you know, write pamphlets or make movies or podcasts that's going to change the cultural norm in Niger? No way. I don't live there. I don't know the culture. I don't understand the culture. So that culture has to kind of change from inside. And so one of the better efforts out there at doing that is the Population Media Center, another nonprofit, where they actually will go into these countries where they perceive the greatest need and the greatest opportunity, and they work with people in that culture and help. They give them the tools and the training to turn them into soap opera producers, radio dramas, or in some cases they're doing television or web series, where they model smaller family decisions. They find ways to work those issues into the plots of their programs. And I guess in some ways it wouldn't be that different from, you know, from some of the really groundbreaking television programs that have been done in the U.S., you know, that didn't have necessarily a real overt goal of changing our culture. But I'm thinking of shows like All in the Family that made it so that we could talk about bigotry and racism and, you know, kind of brought it up, you know, out from under the rug and put some attention on it just by, you know, putting it into some entertainment. So I think that's kind of the approach that Population Media Center is doing around the world. And beyond that, you know, I don't know, as a guy, you know, a pretty privileged guy in the middle of the United States, I think the best I can do is make sure everybody who I can reach is really fully informed so that they're making good family size decisions and so that they will support family planning aid around the world. We can't possibly give that too much support, and so that they will support efforts like those of Population Media Center.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I have two questions in one. We've talked about population, obviously some, and can you talk a little bit about growth busters and also I forgot the second half. If I think of the second half, I'll ask you. Can you talk about growth busters for a minute?
Sure. And then maybe the second half was the billboard campaign for world population balance. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that. Well, so Growth Busters is the project that I created when I decided to make the documentary about our suicidal obsession with growth. And when that film was released in 2011, but I continued the project because the education of the world wasn't complete. And in fact, in some respects, I've made so darn little progress getting the world to recognize that so many of our policy goals and so much of our behavior is just not sustainable. So I continue that project with the Growth Busters podcast and public speaking and things like that. I think we've got a webinar series that we did a couple years ago, and by the time this episode's out, that will be our little free period that we've made those available for free, and the Growth Busters movie for free. Those will be over. But if somebody gets on the email list at growthbusters.org, that'll be their best chance of learning when we will make those available free again. But they can certainly become a supporter of the Growth Busters project and have access to the webinars, and you can buy or rent the movie. On the Billboard project for World Population Balance, we just decided it's time. It is time to bring that subject out from under the rug, make sure that all the people who are, it's just amazing how many journalists and policymakers and pundits, not let alone the general public, first of all, are not aware of overshoot. They're not aware of overpopulation. They don't understand how in 100 years, with a one child family average, we could be back down at about 3 billion people in just 100 years. It's a solvable problem. And so we did a crowdfunding campaign and we launched the One Planet, One Child billboard campaign right at the wrong time. The billboards went up just as everybody was told to stay at home, and there weren't a bunch of commuters driving by our billboards, and the news media didn't want to talk about it because it's coronavirus 24/7. But we did launch a great website called oneplanetonechild.org, and that project's going to continue. We're going to continue to be looking for good advertising venues so that we can demonstrate what it would take. We just need every country around the world to have a public campaign to rally the public, just like they were, just like we've been rallied to shelter at home right now in the COVID-19 situation. We need to rally the public to say, you know what, we are not going to have an overpopulated world. It is, we're going to celebrate one child families. We're going to celebrate everybody's choice to either be child free or to have fewer children. That's all it'll take.
And I remember the other part of it, which is the thing that holds all of this together. Can you talk for just a couple minutes about a refusal to accept limits? Because that's, for me, that feels like part of what is the base of both the refusal to accept limits on human population and the refusal to accept limits on economic growth. And can you talk about that for just a moment, and then end on a happy note?
I'll give it a shot. You may only be happy with half of my answer, because I think one half of the answer is that there is a part of our society that gets richer as long as we ignore the limits. You know, it is in their best short-term financial interest to keep us, you know, on this suicide mission. And so there's a lot of money, you know, being spent on propaganda to convince us that, you know what, there aren't limits, that human ingenuity and technology will solve our problems. Look what we did. Paul Ehrlich predicted mass starvation, and we came up with the Green Revolution. We just need another green revolution now so that we can feed the next 3 or 4 billion people that we want to add to the planet. So there's a lot of money going into, you know, into denial. And of course, media companies, you know, they need lots of eyeballs or ears in order to sell to advertisers. So they're not really highly motivated for us to get a handle on overpopulation. They would like a growing market. So that works against us. I think that's just part of it. The other part of it is some kind of psychological, you know, feeling of being invincible, I think. And maybe part three would be, what, you know, look at recent history. We've had a pretty darn successful 200-year, almost 300-year binge, where a lot of things seemed to get a lot better as we grew. And so there's this really strong myth. In fact, the way I characterize it is that it's the biggest, strongest, most powerful religion in the world is the worship of growth everlasting. That is huge. So that's my answer to that question. And how in the world do I segue to a happy ending? You know, why are we doing this? There must be a ray of hope. Otherwise, I should be out on the golf course today.
I think also you're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And there is a certain satisfaction that comes from telling the truth.
Yeah, there's some integrity to that, living with integrity. And it's, you know, it is the most meaningful work. When I set out to make the Growthbusters documentary, I didn't realize I was kind of taking a vow of poverty. I was becoming a starving filmmaker. And my life as, and so I don't make very much money to this day, but my life is so much better than it was when I was on the treadmill in service to that system, that unsustainable system. I mean, there is a lot of joy in living sustainably.
I think you've said a whole bunch of really great things. And I think for me, at least, the most important thing you said was the last thing about religion a moment ago. And can you end with that? Can you talk for just 20 seconds about the religion of, how did you call it?
The worship of growth everlasting.
Yeah. Can you talk about that for literally 20 seconds?
Well, this religion, this worship of growth everlasting, when you think about it, it is big. It is so powerful that we've been trying to get a handle on climate change for a few decades. And the one thing that we haven't been willing to do is sacrifice economic growth in order to save ourselves. That's how powerful it is. If we can somehow find a way to throw economic growth, or just throw growth, off of its pedestal, that is our hope. We've got to knock it off of its pedestal, because it is a false god, and it's really keeping us from rediscovering the true joy of living.
Well, thank you so much for being a blasphemer against the worship of growth everlasting. And thanks for all your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dave Gardner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio and the Progressive Radio Network.